Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Kabbalah and Coffee. So today we have a very special class. So one topic that we're going to focus on is chuppah, the chuppah canopy part of a wedding, and what it means mystically, what it means according to Kabbalah. So this class, this series called The Majestic Bride, is all about relationships and connections and intimacy and marriage and just joining of human beings together. And we know, of course, at a wedding, at a Jewish wedding, one of the major features is the chuppah canopy. So let's discuss for a few minutes right at the top, what are the origins of the chuppah? So in other words, like, where does the whole chuppah come from? Why do we do it? What does it mean? And then we'll explore the Kabbalah of the chuppah. So that's tonight's, not tonight, it's not night, that's today's topic of conversation. Okay, so the chuppah, the earliest origins that we have for the chuppah as we know it today is around the 1400s, 1500s. So, which is relatively recent when you think about it. It's not like a 2,000-year-old thing in the current form. And when I say current form, I mean the chuppah as most of us picture with the four poles and the canopy on top. You know, either under the sky or in a hall or in a synagogue. So that's a little bit somewhat of a relatively newer tradition. But the word chuppah is an ancient word, and you find it used in Talmudic times, and you find it used throughout Jewish literature as part of a wedding. So it's changed a little bit, because in more ancient times, the chuppah was actually the home or a room in the home. Sure. Of the groom. So when they went to the chuppah, it was really like a space, like a living space that the new bride would go into, and with that husband and wife, it was part of the marriage process. But be that as it may, the way it's evolved over the last five centuries or so is that this portable canopy is set up with four poles, whether they're held by individuals. Some weddings will have more of a temporary chuppah where you need someone to actually hold the poles or else it's going to collapse on bride and groom, which is not a good idea. Or sometimes they build it out as more of a solid structure. But either way, the features of a chuppah typically are open walls. In other words, it has the poles, but there's nothing that covers the walls. But the top is covered with some sort of fabric. Some have the custom to have something ornate and colorful. Some use a tallit. A prayer shawl of interest, maybe it's someone in the family, maybe it's the groom, whatever it is, to use a prayer shawl. Either way, sometimes it's decorated with flowers. Be that as it may, the chuppah is an integral part of the wedding ceremony. And it's under the chuppah that the bride and the groom stand while the process unfolds. So, the giving of the ring, which signifies the betrothal of husband and wife, so the giving of the ring happens under the chuppah. The blessings and the drinking of the wine happens under the chuppah. The reading of the ketubah happens, the marriage document, under the chuppah. The reciting of the seven blessings, the seven brachot, sheva brachot, the seven blessings following all of that, again, under the chuppah. The smashing of the glass to signify the end of the chuppah ceremony, all under the chuppah. So it's under the chuppah that this magical process happens. So what is it about the chuppah that is so significant? So on a very basic level, like it was in ancient times, where the wife or the bride would enter the chamber, the bridal chamber of the groom, signifying their union together as a new family or as a new unit, so too today, okay, look, most people, I don't know that I can say most people, but a lot of weddings don't happen in someone's home. Right? Is that a safe thing to say? Right? Most weddings don't usually happen in the groom's home necessarily. I guess sometimes it happens in people's backyards or whatever on occasion. But usually it's in a neutral location. Some sort of, you know, a hall, a synagogue, whatever it is, some sort of neutral location. So it's not going to be in the groom's house or whatever. So we set up a canopy, and that canopy is said to be a space reminiscent of the exclusive space of bride and groom. By the way, you should know that at a wedding, the custom, as I've been mentioning, is that the bride and groom should stand under the chuppah. No one else has to stand under the chuppah, theoretically. It's like the rabbi, although the rabbi usually stands under the chuppah, doesn't have to. Others, you don't really have to stand under the chuppah. The main thing is that the bride and groom stand under the chuppah, because that this signifies their collective space. It's like a mini home. And I think I mentioned in a previous class that one of the reasons why we don't have walls is to signify that this home, this space that the bride and the groom are creating should be a space that doesn't have any walls. It's a space that ought not have any barriers of separation between the parties, between husband and wife, between bride and groom. No walls of, you know, no conflict, no emotional walls and barriers, no intellectual walls or barriers. It should be, you know, freely flowing between the two parties. I mean, that's the ideal, and that's the goal, and that's some of the symbolism. Very interesting Talmudic statement. The Talmud cites a very interesting tradition. The Talmud says that in ancient times, so when a boy was born, they would plant a cedar tree. And when a girl was born, they would plant a pine tree. Now, I'm not a big planter of trees. I've worked with trees in Atlanta, but I've never followed up. I don't know how long these trees take. How long does a cedar tree take to grow? Take a long time or a short time? Long time?
Most trees take a long time.
Well, so I don't know how but here's what the Talmud says. When a boy was born, you know, today.
Actually,
you
can, a cedar tree is not going to grow nearly as fast as a pine.
Cedar will be slower. Okay.
Pines grow a lot faster than cedars.
Okay.
Makes it a difference.
Well, you'll see where I'm going with this. So it says, so today, you know, when you have a milestone or a life cycle event, sometimes you'll get a certificate. Somebody will buy you a tree in Israel. Right? You ever get that? Like JNF, you get a tree in Israel. I have a lot of trees that I've gotten over the years, or that have been planted, you know, for some reason. But in ancient Israel, in ancient times, when a boy was born, they would plant a tree for that child, a cedar tree for the boy, and a pine tree for the girl. And when they got married, the Talmud says, they would take from the cedar and the pine, and they would create the chuppah out of that. So it seems like, although other places indicate that they would get married by her going into his home, it seems like they also did create somewhat of a foliage, natural, you know, some sort of thing made from the trees, because it does say in the Talmud that they would use his cedar and her pine. And the cool thing about that is you don't have to know who you're going to marry to plant, right? As long as everyone's got a cedar, everyone's got a pine, right? We're good to go. But I think it's a very, I'm going to use the word cute, but not in a dismissive way, but I think it's very endearing and charming, this custom. Anyway, maybe we should bring it back on some, you know, somehow. So be that as it may, the chuppah is a very important part of the marriage ceremony. And Kabbalah speaks of the more spiritual or Kabbalistic significance of the chuppah experience. So let's jump in. We're going to jump in straight away to the text. This is on page 28. And we've established thus far that when it comes to relationships, and including the relationship of bride and groom, you have always, in every interaction, you have mashpia mekabel, which is giver and recipient. So if people are talking, you have someone who's talking and the other one is listening. And when the conversation switches, that person is talking and this one is listening. But be that as it may, you're always dealing with a give and a take, a giver and a receiver. That's the nature of a relationship. And we've further explained that although it seems that if we were measuring stature, if we were trying to rank who is higher, a giver or a receiver, we would think that a giver always stands above the receiver, because that's the nature of the relationship, right? So when a person has and the other one doesn't, so the one that has might feel superior, and the one that doesn't might feel inferior. That might be the power balance, if you will, of that type of relationship of giving and receiving. Although that might appear to be the case, the way things kind of unfold on a physical plane, the truth is, on a much deeper level, the mekabel, the recipient, stems from a greater source and has a greater power than the giver. We use the examples, again, the last few weeks we've used the examples of planting a seed in the earth. We've used the example of procreation, etc. The point is that in Kabbalah, a recipient, a makabel, is actually standing on a higher level than the giver, even though the way it plays out on a physical level is that the giver may look like the giver is standing above the recipient. Nonetheless, the recipient is actually standing on a higher level than the giver. Than the giver is. Okay. So all that we covered before. So now we're going to translate that into some of the ceremony of the Jewish wedding, and now we'll focus on chuppah. So that takes us to page 28. So let's jump straight into it. Right at the top, encompassing chuppah. So right at the beginning of this new section, so our discourse is going to cite a verse from Isaiah. There aren't that many verses in Torah that use the word chuppah. I think there's only two or three times that we find the word chuppah, canopy, used. Just a handful of times. Isaiah is one of them, and it talks about the end of days, and it's a very interesting verse. So let's start. It is written, again, Isaiah chapter 4. The quote is, "For over all the honor, there will be a chuppah, canopy." So now, what does that mean and what's the context? I want to draw your attention, please, to footnote 21. So take a look at footnote 21. By the way, you should know, for those that don't know, I actually translated this discourse, so any issues with the translation that I find, I have to blame myself or my editors, and the footnotes I wrote as well. So footnote 21, Isaiah 4:5, this verse in Isaiah's prophecy of the Messianic era speaks of the divine protection that will be afforded to the righteous to protect them from the destruction that will rain down upon the wicked. So sometimes in Isaiah and other biblical prophecies, you'll find not necessarily like Armageddon and like, I don't know if that's the right term. Armageddon, is that the right term? Like a, yeah? Or apocalypse. Apocalypse is what I was looking for. Yeah, like apocalyptic type. But you do find that there's some sort of mention of, you know, not great stuff that's going to rain down upon, you know, those who are evildoers, etc. But here's the context of Isaiah 4, and this actually has two verses, verses 4 and 5 of chapter 4. So it says like this: "When the Lord will have washed the filth of the daughters of Zion and rinsed the blood of Jerusalem from her midst with a spirit of judgment and a spirit of purging, God will create over every structure of Mount Zion and over those who assemble in it a cloud by day and smoke and a glow of flaming fire by night. For over all the honor, there will be a chuppah." So that's the quote in totality. Basically, it says, in the Messianic era, when God cleanses the daughters of Zion from their filth, which is symbolic of basically God lifting up the downtrodden, right? The righteous. You know what they say? Nice guys finish last, right? It's we live in a world where the greatest tzaddik may not be, you know, you have good people that have a lot of suffering. So in the Messianic era, truth is true. You know, instead of it being a topsy-turvy world where, you know, the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, so things are going to be flipped. So God will wash the filth of the daughters of Zion, rinse the blood of Jerusalem from amid, so cleanse out, you know, from all the negativity of that which is pure. And then it says that God will create over the righteous a cloud by day and a smoke and a glow of flaming fire by night. God will basically create a canopy, a chuppah, a protective canopy over Zion and Jerusalem and those that are there. That's what it says. But it says, for over all the honor there will be a chuppah. What is the honor? So honor basically means those that are honorable, in other words, the righteous. For over all the honor, all of the tzaddikim, all of the righteous, there will be this protective cover. God will protect the righteous in the Messianic era. As opposed to now, when even if a person is righteous, there's no guarantee that they're going to live a good life. When Mashiach comes, right will be recognized as right, and wrong will be recognized as wrong, and good is good, and evil is evil, etc. And everything is clear, and good happens to good, and bad happens to bad. Or whatever, right? You know, there are consequences, etc. But again, the key phrase here is in the Hebrew, ki al kol kavod chuppah. Over all the honor, there is a canopy, there is a chuppah. So back inside, back above the line into the main text. So in the Kabbalistic understanding of the verse, we can understand it in the context of our relationship with God and in the context of a wedding between a bride and a groom. In other words, once we mention the word chuppah and honor, so now we can expound and break that apart and break it down and understand what it means on a much deeper level. Okay, so let's begin. In the brackets, second line from the top. The word all, it says over all the honor. It doesn't say for upon the honor there will be a chuppah. It says upon all of the honor there will be a chuppah. Now, the word all, kol in Hebrew, is an inclusive term. It means not only is this canopy over those that are honorable, but it's over all of the honor. So what's all? What does it include? So he says the word all indicates, in this way of understanding, that there are two kinds of honor encompassed by this chuppah. There's two dimensions of honor. It's not just one dimension of honor, because then it would say upon, over, the honor is a chuppah. No, it doesn't say over the honor. It says over all the honor. There's two levels of honor. The honor of the groom and the honor of the bride. In the Hebrew, it's kvod chatan u'kvod kala. There's the honor of the groom and honor of the bride. Now, we can understand this again on two different levels. Whether it's our relationship with God, which we'll begin with, or a bride and a groom relationship. Literally, the honor of a groom and the honor of a bride by an actual wedding. But the point of all this is the following. You have two parties. There's the bride and the groom, or the groom and the bride, right? So there's two parties. Each one possesses kavod, which is honor, which we haven't yet explained what honor is. What is honor? And then above the honor of both the bride and the groom, there is a chuppah canopy. You with me? So you have two parties. Each one possesses honor, honor of this one, honor of that one. And above all of that, you have the canopy. So now we need to break down all the terms and find some meaning, Kabbalistic meaning, in all of this. First, we begin in our spiritual relationship with God. So let's continue second paragraph. In the context of God's relationship with the Jewish people, and this is a relationship, not so parenthetically, that is referred to in many sources as a marriage. So, for example, King Solomon's famous work, Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, speaks of our relationship with God in the context of a romantic relationship. And I've mentioned this before in previous classes, where you have different ways of relating to God, like a subject and a master, a servant and a king, a child and a parent, and a spouse and a spouse, a wife to a husband, right? So that there are different forms and modalities of relationships, and here we're going to focus on the relationship in the model of husband and wife. So here we go. In the context of God's relationship with the Jewish people, God is called the groom, and the Jewish people are called His bride. Where do we see this? As the sages comment on the scriptural phrase on His wedding day. So our sages comment in the Talmud, this is the giving of the Torah. I meant to actually put this, it's not in the footnote, and I meant to actually print this out as a handout, but I didn't. So I'm going to pull it up on my phone. So here we go. I want to give you the whole context. Check this out. This is Song of Songs, Chapter 3. I'm going to read to you the last three verses of chapter 3. King Solomon made himself a palanquin. What's a palanquin? Anybody know what a palanquin is? Huh? Palanquin? What is that? In India and the East, a covered litter for one passenger consisting of a large box carried on two horizontal poles by four or six bearers. What is that?
How do you spell it?
P-A-L-A-N-Q-U-I-N. Oh, here we go. One of these.
It's like a hook.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like one of these guys. Mm-hmm. One of those boxes with the poles?
Yeah.
Looks like a very comfy way. This is Uber in its original form. It's like, folks, take me to the market, huh?
That's what they carried Yul Brynner in.
Who's that? I feel like I should know.
Who's Yul Brynner?
He's an actor.
Who played Moses?
Was that him? No, it was Charlton. Okay,
Pharaoh.
In Ten Commandments. I know Charlton Heston played Moses. I didn't know. Okay. So King Solomon made himself a palanquin of the trees of Lebanon. Okay. Its pillars he made of silver. Its couch of gold. Its curtain of purple. Its interior inlaid with love from the daughters of Jerusalem. Go out, O daughters of Zion, and gaze upon King Solomon, upon the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his nuptials and on the day of the joy of his heart. This is, these are the last three verses of Song of Songs. What does it mean? It's very poetic, but what does it actually mean? So Rashi comments that what is the palanquin? I didn't know what it means literally, but I can tell you what Rashi says. Rashi says it means, it refers to the tent of meeting, to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle that the Jews transported, the portable sanctuary that the Jews took in the desert. So just like a palanquin is a portable thing that you carry, right, a portable structure, so too the tabernacle was a portable structure. It's couch of gold. This refers to the ark cover, which was gold. The curtain of purple is the dividing curtain that existed in the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Okay, and there are different explanations. But the bottom line is, it talks about here, go out, O daughters of Zion, and gaze upon King Solomon, upon the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, and on the day of the joy of his heart. So what is the day of his wedding? Rashi says, on the day of his nuptials, the day of the giving of the Torah, when they crowned God king for themselves and accepted his yoke. So what is the day of the wedding? The day of the wedding is the day of Matan Torah, the day of the giving of the Torah, when God gave the Jewish people the Torah. So that is the moment of the chuppah, if you will, between God and the Jewish people. I will tell you, the Talmud also says elsewhere that when God offered the Jewish people the Torah, God lifted, are you familiar with this? God lifted the mountain, Mount Sinai, above the heads of the Jewish people and said, if you accept the Torah, fantastic. If not, you'll be buried under this mountain. How romantic, right? But the point is that there was a mountain at some point, at least according to the Talmud, hovering over their head. Now, the Talmud bases this because the Torah says that the Jewish people stood under the mountain at Sinai. It doesn't say at the foot of the mountain. The literal word that's used is not at the foot of the mountain. Tachat Ha'har means under the mountain. So Talmud says, why does it say under the mountain and not at the bottom of the mountain? There's another Hebrew word that says bottom of the mountain. It says, because God lifted the mountain. Anyway, so some say that this is the first origin. So the Jews and God got married at Sinai, so to speak, right? They joined in this relationship. The Torah document or the Ten Commandments, whatever, is like the ketubah, the marriage contract, like the rules of engagement. And God pledged his love and gave, right? Like the groom gives a ring. So God gave the Torah, all of the symbolism. What was the chuppah? The mountain hovering over their heads. Okay. Either way, the bottom line is that the giving of the Torah at Sinai was the time of this union of God and the Jewish people. And in that relationship, God is certainly the giver and we are the recipients. Because God gave the Torah and we received the Torah. Right? The Torah was only given by one party. It was given by God and received by the Jewish people. So when we talk about the giver-receiver relationship, and in general, the way we understand this in our text is that, although in a relationship, both parties are givers and receivers, but at least in the context of that we've been talking about in procreation, etc., so the groom is going to be the giver, and the bride the receiver, which does not imply hierarchy, but just implies, you know, different roles, if you will, right? So the groom is the giver and the bride is the receiver. So in the context of our relationship with God, so God is the giver, God is the groom, God gave us the Torah, and we receive the Torah at Sinai. And so we're the recipient, so therefore we are called the bride. Okay, let's continue. So now we have three terms that we're trying to decipher, right? We have bride and groom, we have honor, and then we have the chuppah that covers over all of the honor of both the bride and the groom. So we've defined one of them, who's the groom and who's the bride, God and the Jewish people. Now, what is the honor in this context? So it says, in third paragraph 28, an honor refers to a quality that encompasses. This is very important. Honor is a level that in Hebrew and Kabbalah is called makif. What is makif? So I want to give you an example. There are three basic necessities in life. Now, why do I say that they're basic necessities? Because this is what we were taught in social studies class as a kid. What are the three basics of life? Food, clothing, and shelter. Remember that? Food, clothing, shelter? Three basic needs of life? Okay. Each one differs in the degree... Awesome. Oh. Each one differs. You want to call it? Each one differs in the degree of closeness to the individual. So think about it this way. Where does food go? What's the food in relationship to the person? Inside, right? Food is internal. We eat food and it goes inside. So food is really close. Clothing? Outside. But it's still close. It's still close to the body. Shelter, a house, is also outside, but it's distant. It's not... A home doesn't move with you unless you're a turtle, right? And then it's something else, right? So it's mazon, levush, and bayit in Hebrew. Mazon is food, levush is garment, and bayit is house. Three different levels of the relationship between something outside, something different than you to you. So food starts off different, right? It's outside. But then the relationship is, you take it in. And it becomes part of your blood, your flesh and blood. It becomes part of you. So you take it in, and now it's one with you in the closest way. That's food. Clothing always remains distant, right? We don't eat our clothing, right? Clothing remains outside. Still, clothing is tailored to a person, right? If it's too big, it can make you trip. It can trip you up, right? If it's too small, it doesn't fit. So it has to be tailored to a person. And each person has a distinction about which clothing they wear based on who they are. So clothing, although it's not part of the person, and it surrounds the person, but it's still measured to the person. So it's still some sort of intimacy to the person in the sense that it's tailored to the person. Whereas a house seems like the most distant, the most, not in a negative way, but I'm going to use a negative term, like kind of standoffish. But it's not really like, it's not really hostile, it's just distant. It's in a sense impersonal. And how do I know this? Because you can have a house, different. You can have guests in your house, right? Many people can come, or people can come into your house. So it's not exclusively tailored to you. Although, of course, the way we decorate it and the way even the outside, it reflects our taste and our preference, perhaps, whatever. But nonetheless, many people can fit in under the same roof because a house is not tailored to one person, the owner, but it's rather a larger space that encompasses a vast area, including the owner of the home. But it's much larger. So these are three different dimensions. One is panimi, which is inside. Not panini, that's a food. But it's also, I guess, someone, right? Panimi is inside. Then you have makiv hakarov, which is the encompassing dimension, but it's close. And then you have makiv harachok, which is encompassing, but distant, but far. That's the house. Now, in Kabbalah, it says that these three levels correspond in varying degrees to higher and higher dimensions of spirituality. So a lower dimension of spirituality is what goes inside of creation in an internal way. So the divine energy that permeates a table or that permeates a chair, because everything has divine energy or else it wouldn't exist. So that divine energy has descended and diminished slowly, like gradually, thinner, thinner, finer, finer, finer. The light is diminished to the point that it can go inside a physical chair. It's not like the full totality of divine energy, because you wouldn't have a physical chair. So it's a very small divine energy that's inside the chair. The divine energy that surrounds the chair, but is close to the chair, is a higher level, but it's still relative to the chair, so it still has some sort of relativity, relativism, so it's also somewhat diminished from the original. The essence of divine energy that doesn't care whether it's a chair, whether it's a person, or whether it's a sun, or whether it's an earth, this is the divine energy on its terms, so it just shines, and it just surrounds. Whatever's inside the space, it doesn't care, like the house. It just is. It's a large space. And whatever's inside, come on, you know, come one, come all. So this is divine energy that is the highest, the deepest, the greatest, and it's not measured to any specific recipient of the energy. It just shines on its own accord. That's the highest dimension of divine light. So again, these three dimensions correspond to three successively deeper or higher forms of divine light. The divine light that goes inside creation is the lowest. The divine light that surrounds creation, but it's close to creation, is the middle level. The divine light that encompasses creation in a distant way, not even caring what's inside almost, that's the highest degree of divine light. Sometimes it says like this. The divine light that goes inside is the divine light that affects creation. The divine light that surrounds but is tailored to creation is the source of creation within God. You with me? In other words, God's decision to create, before creation happens, the decision to create is already a divine light that's now foreshadowing or foretelling creation, even though it hasn't been limited yet, but that divine energy that's flowing at that point is a divine light that's now the source of creation. So you have the light that's in creation itself, that's measured. You have the source of creation, so it's higher than creation itself. That's not the light that's going inside, but that's the light that still wants to create, so it's still in the context of creation, so that's like the clothing. And then you have the divine essence that's totally beyond creation. And that is like the house. I'll give you another example. This is an example that I use many times, and I think it should bring this out nicely. So you have an artist that's creating art. A painter. I go to my go-to painter. Who's my go-to painter? Who's my go-to? Bob Ross. I mean, come on. Bob Ross. Right? Bob Ross. He was awesome.
That's Corn's favorite.
Happy Trees. Happy Trees. Who's great? Remember Bob Ross? The guy on PBS or whatever it is, used to paint in a half an hour. He had the big... The guy would paint, he would knock out a painting in 30 minutes. You're like, wow, that's a nice painting. I can't do that. See, Howard, can you... It looks like somebody inadvertently hit the lock on the door. Thank you. Remember Bob? So Bob Ross, he was always like, the guy could turn around the painting like this. You should know, I don't know if you know the origin story of Bob Ross. Do you guys know the origin story? He was in one of the wars. He was like a sniper. Yeah. He saw some crazy things. And like, he wasn't in a great place when he got back. Like, he wasn't in a good and this the painting was like therapeutic for him, and it was like healing for him, and that's how he lived. He lived creatively and like very soft spoken, and he was put in a context where he had to be, you know, he had to kill and whatever, and this was his way. Anyway, so you think about the creative experience of someone who's very creative. So there's three levels, right? So there's as the individual is creating, is painting, let's say Bob Ross, like painting the happy trees. I remember he used to take like, used to be like, you couldn't even see what was going on really. It was like, what's that going to be? And then he just takes one thing, one line, and he goes down. It's like, oh my God, it's a tree. And then he did the, remember? So there's, as the painter is painting, the energy that he or she is investing in it is a very internal energy. It's like very involved in that experience, right? Like you have the brush. I'm going to use this thing as my brush, right? You're dipping in the brush, you're painting, you're doing your thing. At that moment, the artist is investing his or her energy into the experience in a very internal way. It's not aloof. It's not looking at it from the outside. It's not like the energy is invested in that moment. It's like food. Just like food goes inside. I know you're not eating the paint or whatever it is, but the artist in that moment is very closely invested in that experience. Okay. Take a step back. Take a step out of the painting before he or she paints. So thinking about what I want to paint before I'm painting. I'm not actually painting now. This is before. Let's rewind history. So I'm now thinking. I have a blank canvas in front of me, and I can do any number of things. I can do a portrait of somebody. I can do a landscape. I can do. That's all I know. I'm not an artist. Those are the two options that I know of. I'm sure there are other options. Whatever, right? So people are things, right? So. But the possibilities are open. You're a creative person. So when you start deciding in your mind what it is that you're going to create, so you're not yet doing the painting, you're still outside of that experience, but the energy that you're investing in this type of calculation, in this type of consideration, is an energy that's broader than the specific moment of painting this stroke or that stroke with this color. It's outside of that, but you're still thinking about what you're going to do. So even though you're thinking about it in general terms, you're not as invested on the ground as when you're actually painting. So it's you're kind of mapping out your game planning, what it is that you're going to do. So it's outside. It's a step back. It's looking at the broader picture, but it's still looking at the broader picture of what will be the picture. In other words, it's not the broader picture totally detached from anything practical. You're looking at a broader picture of what you're actually going to create as a picture or as a painting. So that's like clothing. It's outside. It's removed from the experience of actually painting, but it's still tailored to what it is that's going to be delivered. Then you have the artist as he or she exists on their own outside of the whole creative experience. When they wake up in the morning, when they're just having their own experiences outside of the realm of painting. In other words, their essence, their pure essence, outside of moving to think about this canvas or actually painting and creating this art, the artist, him or herself, in essence, that is the makiv harachok, the encompassing dimension of the house, so to speak. So three levels. One, close investment or close contact in the closest way. Then you have that which encompasses. So it's a higher level, right? It's a higher light, but it's still somewhat tailored to the specifics, somewhat. And then you have the highest level, which is not even tailored to any specifics. It's almost like the source on its own terms, not measure. It's like a house. The house is not conforming to the buyer. The house is like, look, I'm here. If you want to jump inside, you want to buy me, no problem. But these are my parameters, right? It's on my terms. You like it? Fine. But I'm not conforming to you. Whereas clothing is, you take a big sheet of, you take some material, and now you cut it down to fit the person. A house, you're not cutting down to fit the person. The house is large on its own terms, and then whoever wants to go in can go in. Three different levels. Bottom line is that you have this concept of makif, which means that which encompasses. And within a person, within the human experience, in addition to the food, clothing, and shelter example, we have other things that are considered. We have this duality of inside-outside when it comes to other things as well, or internal and encompassing. We have the same duality. For example, and this is the example that we bring in the footnotes here. The difference between intelligence and, to use the word that's found here in the discourse, honor. What is the difference between intelligence and honor? If you give someone information, wisdom, or you give or you bestow upon someone honor, kavod, you teach someone something, or you honor them at a dinner. What's the difference? On their end, on their recipient end. You give them wisdom, What happens to the wisdom? Right? You teach someone wisdom. What do they do with it? They internalize it. Right? They can understand it. It now goes inside their minds. You honor someone at a dinner. What happens? They feel good about it. But what do they get? In other words, you don't get... Honor is something that still remains, in the language of Kabbalah, it remains in a level of makif. It encompasses the person. Reminds me of a video that I once saw where some of the heads of the Jewish Federation, the National Jewish Federation, visited the Lubavitcher Rebbe. This is probably in the 80s. And the video is hilarious. So, whatever. I think the chairs or the heads. So, there's a man and a woman and they're visiting. And so, they say, you know, we want to give you an update what we're doing for Jewish education around the country. You know, as the heads of federation, like this is all that we're doing. We're giving to the Jewish school system in the United States in total, millions of dollars, whatever it is that they're doing for Jewish education. And the Rebbe says to one of these, to one of them, he says, thank you, like he appreciated the update and the information and the good work. And then he said something, he said, do you remember, the Rebbe said to this guy, if you recall, last time we met, I told you such and such. He's basically saying, like, this is great, but I told you something specific, so what's the update with that? And the fellow says, Rabbi, you're amazing. You're amazing that you remember that. You're, like, unbelievable. Like, he probably didn't remember that. And the Rebbe, like, who met, like, millions, like, thousands, tens of thousands of people, remember that specific conversation with this guy. So he's like, Rabbi, you're amazing. So the Rebbe smiles and looks at him and smiles and says, and if I'm amazing, like, how does that benefit anyone? Like, what do I get out of being amazing? Like, you're saying I'm amazing, but okay, but how does it translate into anything tangible? The point is that when you honor someone, you give someone a compliment or whatever it is, what do they actually get out of it? They get a nice feeling of being complimented, but you don't actually, you can't do anything with it. Whereas if somebody gives you information, you can use that information, because it's you've internalized it. So somebody gives you a formula. Someone gives you a life lesson. Whatever it is, someone gives you wisdom. You can use it. It's yours. You can take it. You can work with it. Someone gives you a compliment. It feels nice, but it's still kind of surrounding you. Like, what do you do with it? You can't actually use it for anything. Okay. So when the verse in Isaiah talks about this canopy, this wedding canopy, and it's said in the future times of Mashiach, and it says that the wedding canopy is covering over all of the honor. There is a chuppah over all the honor. So what is all? Groom and bride. What is groom and bride? God and the Jewish people. What is honor? What is honor? Honor is that which surrounds. Honor is not wisdom, which is inside, internal. Honor is something that remains outside, remains aloof. In the context of a relationship, this refers to love. When you express, so I know honor and love are not synonymous, but in our discourse, we're going to draw a parallel between the two. Because just like honor or a compliment is not something internal, so too professing love for someone is likewise something that's not internal. In other words, you tell someone you love them, again, you're not giving them wisdom that they can use or whatever it is. You're letting them know how you feel, which is it's a wonderful thing, but it's still at the level of makif. By the way, not necessarily is makif a negative thing, the surrounding encompassing a negative thing. On the contrary, as I mentioned before, it's actually a higher degree, but it's just not internalized. It's not an internal thing. It's something that remains transcendent, if you will. So let's read this inside, third paragraph, 28. And honor refers to a quality that encompasses. Again, honor, a compliment, is not internal like knowledge. It rather encompasses. Thus, And now we draw the connection between honor, which encompasses, and love, which encompasses. The honor of the groom refers to God's love of the Jewish people, as it is written. And this is a verse from 27 from Malachi. The verse says, "Ahavti eschem, amar Hashem, I have loved you, says God." So God's love for the Jewish people is the groom's honor. And the honor of the bride is the Jewish people's love for God. As it is written, my soul yearns. Indeed, it pines for the courtyards of the Lord. And this is a verse from Tehillim from Psalms. Nichsefa v'gam kosa nafshi. So we have here verses in Scripture that refer to God's love of the Jewish people and the Jewish people's love of God or for God. And what he says is love is not a quality that is expressed or that typically when love is conveyed, it's not an internal type of experience. It's an encompassing, it's a transcendent emotion. So it's the level of makif. So now we have almost everything defined. We have groom and bride defined, God and the Jewish people. We have honor defined, love of each to the, of one to the other and the other to the other, right? So God's love for the Jewish people love for God. Now all we're left with is, well, what's the chuppah? So we have God and the Jewish people in the spiritual example of a relationship, God and the Jewish people, and each one loves the other, but for some reason you still need the chuppah. By the way, this is true at a regular wedding, right? You have groom and bride, and each one is standing under there, hopefully because they love each other. And yet, in addition to the love, which is already a level of makif, right? Love is a surrounding level. You need to be under a canopy that further surrounds the two. You with me on this? You need to have love, which is a surrounding energy and encompassing energy. So you have to have the two individuals. Love that each has for the other, plus a canopy, a wedding canopy, that surrounds the surrounding dimension of each of them. So the parties, the love, and then the chuppah. Why do you need a chuppah? So again, he's speaking in the context of a spiritual relationship, but it's all about, this was said at a wedding, it's all about the human relationship, but let's just stick with the way he's framing it. So look what he says. Last paragraph in 28. And the chuppah, what's the chuppah? It's an even loftier level that generally encompasses both groom and bride. And here we get to the third level of makif. Remember I said before you have a level that is internal, like food, and then you have clothing which encompasses, but it's close, and then you have the deepest level of makif, the deepest level encompassing like the house, and each one is higher than the next. So you have these three elements as well by the chuppah. You have the groom and the bride. They would be, I guess, the internal elements. You have the love that each one possesses for the other, which is encompassing, but it's still close. And then you have the chuppah that is like a house type encompassment that is distant from the two individuals and even from their love. And the way it's understood in Kabbalah is like this. How do you bring together two opposites? This is the great mystery of relationships, right? How do you bring together two opposites, two individuals? Two individuals that have different ideas about life, perhaps, maybe even slightly different goals, different feelings about things. Yeah, they love each other, but they're still two individuals. Even their love, we like to think that love can conquer all, but it's not necessarily true. There's still distinctions even within love. Because even within love, you have the love of the groom and the love of the bride. You still have two different types of love. Right? Even notice in this example, you have the honor, love of the groom and the honor, love of the bride. It's still two different parties. It's love, oh, we love each other, but there's still two different experiences of the love. But there's only one chuppah. There's two loves, there's two people with two loves. Each one loves the other in their own way, but only one chuppah. What does that mean? So in Kabbalah, there's always a formula in Kabbalah, and it goes like this. Whenever you need to bring together two opposites, you need a light that transcends them both to bring them together. For example, here's a very simple example that's brought in Kabbalah. You have different angels, and different angels have different functions. So there's the angel of the angel called Michal, who's the angel of love. And the angel Michal, I guess it's Michael in English, The angel Michal does good things, heals and brings blessings and good tidings and all that stuff. Okay. Then you have the angel Gavriel. Gavriel comes from the word Gvura. Gavriel is more of like a destructive angel. Only, you know, in accordance to God's command. So, for example, in the biblical narrative, when the three angels appear to Abraham, and one angel is coming to give him news about him having a child. One angel is healing him, because he just had a circumcision 3 days earlier. He's coming to heal him and bring him news about him having a son with Sarah. One angel is coming to overturn the city of Sodom, destroy the city. And the other angel is saving Lot. So it says these are three different angels. One angel does not have two different jobs. So every angel has its modality of being. So angel Michal is the healing angel and the good tidings angel. Good news, Michal is here. That's always a good news. Gavriel, the angel Gabriel, watch out. That angel overturned the city of Sodom. That's Gvur. That's like, you know, discipline. Right? You broke the rules? Consequence. So that's Gavriel. I forget who the third angel was that saved Lot. I'm forgetting already which angel that was. But that's saving someone from danger is not exactly the same as bring them good news. It's kind of like rescuing. It's also good, but it's not all good. Anyway, either way, the point is that angels have different functions and different personalities. Now, these are not their own personalities. These are as they're created by God. Nonetheless, angels are distinct. And the way the angel Michal serves God is different than the way Gabriel serves God. Can you imagine an angel of love versus an angel of discipline? They have their own ways of being and their own ways of singing God's praises. And yet it says in Kabbalah that when they stand before Hashem, when they stand before the king, the angels put aside their differences and they equally serve God. In other words, even though maybe, you know, in their off time, they're not going to hang out at the same bar. It's just not, they're not the same angel, right? They're different personalities. They're not going to hang out together. Michal is this and Gavriel is that. Different sides of the divide, right? Love, discipline, kindness, severity, whatever. Nonetheless, standing before God, standing before God, they are equal. Ed, can you pass me a sitter? I'm going to quote for you one of the most famous lines of the prayers. And it's such a famous line that everyone sings it. I'm going to start it. So you can sing it with me if you know it. Oh, Oseh shalom bimromav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu v'yakol Yisrael. Vimru, vimru, amen. What does that mean? It's at the end of the Amidah. It's at the end of the Kaddish. Oseh shalom b'mromav. He who makes peace in heaven, may he make peace for us and for all Israel and say amen. So the same God who makes peace in heaven should make peace with us. So Kabbalah says, what does it mean that he makes peace in heaven? What, is there a war in heaven? Yes. Michal and Gavriel. And by the way, it's not just one angel. In Kabbalah, it's called Machane. You know what Machane means in Hebrew? Machane means camp. There's a camp of Michal and a camp of Gavriel. In other words, there's a whole group of angels in this modality and another group in that modality. So what does it mean in the prayers? It's the prayers. It's not even... Kabbalah explains what it means, but we say this, we sing this in virtually, I don't know, every synagogue that I've been to, you sing this, right? So... He, God, who makes peace on high between different camps of angels, should also make peace on earth between different types of people. We should have peace on earth. That's the prayer, and that's the greatest prayer that we ask for. That's how we end, like the Kaddish and the Amidah. That's how we end these big prayers. But how does God create peace amongst the angels? What does he say? Knock it off, guys. Okay, maybe. No. When God appears, the angels lose their... The angels stop fighting. In other words, when the king appears, so you feel yourself less. As long as you feel yourself in your identity, I am Michal, I am Gavriel, I'm this, you're that. I'm not like you. You're not like me. As long as we feel ourselves and take ourselves very seriously, then we're fragmented. But the moment there's something greater, and we kind of divest ourselves of our, not that we lose our identity, but that our specific identity is not as important right now, so then we can get together. I'll give you an example. And this is not a positive example, it's a negative example, but it's still an example. When natural disasters hit, hopefully you see communities coming together in ways that they might not come together otherwise. You see people helping other people in a way that perhaps they wouldn't under ordinary, normal circumstances. Why? Because at that moment you realize there are more important things than the small, petty things that we usually put to close ourselves off from, to distinguish ourselves from other people. We realize, like, is that really a big deal? Is that really so important that we should say, I can't get along with that person because X, Y, Z? You know, life is at stake. So in a greater moment, in a greater experience, so the distinctions that seem very big, the importance of it kind of shrinks, and we can get together a little bit greater. So when the angels stand before God, and they sense God and not themselves, the angels can get together. The angels can become unified. The same thing is true under the chuppah. You have two individuals. You have the groom and the bride. Soon to be husband and wife, wife and husband. And the question is, how do you bring together two individuals? Even if they love each other. Because even their love is different. He loves her one way and she loves him a different way. It's still not the same love. They're still not speaking the same language. Even if they both say, I love you. Even if they both use the same word love. As I said in the first session together, love means different things to different people. So even if they both say love, it's still two loves. It's still distinct. So how do you bring two individuals with two different forms of love? How do you make them unified? So Kabbalah says that's the role of the chuppah. The chuppah is not just a canopy, but the chuppah is a transmitter. Think of it as a divine antenna. Almost. It transmits the divine energy like it does for the angels. Like the angels standing before the very presence of God, who, in a sense, because of that greater experience, they don't feel themselves as much. So they can connect totally and wholly with the other. The same thing is true under the chuppah. The chuppah is this divine encompassing light, this essential godly energy under which groom and bride can merge together as one. Whenever you have two opposed, either opposing forces or different forces, you bring them together with something that transcends them both. And the energy that transcends them both can bring them together. So for example, if you have to fuse together two metals, what do? You introduce something that is greater or hotter than both of them. You introduce fire, and now you can meld them together. You always, if you have two dry things, I don't know if this is going to work. I'm thinking out loud now. Two dry ingredients, you want to mix them together, so maybe you add some water. I don't know. You always need a third thing to bring the two together. Even marriage or a relationship on a literal level, it helps. Again, this is now just speaking in very reductive terms. So it helps if there is a greater cause that both parties are living toward. In other words, if both parties in a relationship are not just living for themselves, it's not just me and you, and we love each other, and we're hoping that's going to work, but we're actually living with something higher in mind, which is why the Talmud says that when husband and wife introduce God into the relationship, which, what does it mean to introduce God into the relationship? Like, practically, it means that we understand that both parties in the marriage understand that there's something higher that we're working to achieve. We're working to build a home that has hospitality, that it doesn't have the walls, in other words, that people can come in and we welcome people, and we want to build a home of kindness and of goodness and raise our kids a certain way, whatever it is. When there's a common goal that's greater than the two parties, that can do a lot of healing to bring the two parties together. when there's this encompassing light. And that's again symbolized by the chuppah on now on a more expansive level, not the reductive level, but a more expansive level. This is what the chuppah represents. The chuppah represents the divine energy, the divine light that brings together two otherwise distinct parties, the groom and the bride, and even their love for each other, which is transcendent, but it's still two different forms of love. That all is brought together with the chuppah and under the chuppah. So just to quote, finish my quote from the Talmud says that ish v'isha, man and woman, if they merit, then the divine name is with them, the divine presence is with them, and they each have a letter of God's name, and it's ish and isha. So ish is man, isha is woman. So ish is aleph, yud, shin, and isha is aleph, shin, hey. The common letters to man and woman are aleph and shin, which spell the Hebrew word ash, which is fire. The uncommon letter is the yud in ish and the hey in isha, which together, yud and hey, forms the first two letters of God's name. So if man and woman, if the husband and wife have God in the relationship, then he and she can get together. But if God is not in the relationship, if you take out the yud and the hey, all you have left is ash and ash, fire and fire, and then they're going to burn up each other. That's what it says. That's what the Talmud says. A relationship can get very hostile and very combustible, very heated, and very, very, very negative when it's missing something higher, this third element in a relationship. It also says, regarding children, for example, it says that there are three partners in creation of a child: the father, the mother, and God. Now, that means that, you know, the father and the mother can produce the biological part of it, but it's God that provides the soul. But the point is that in general relationships, Judaism encourages and emphasizes this idea, this notion, that it's not just two people getting together, but there's a higher element involved. And this is the symbolism of the chuppah, according to Kabbalah. The chuppah is, we're taking two individuals, which makes no sense. It's like, why would we even try? what's the point? Like, this is crazy. There's no way this is going to work. Two opposites. Put them together. How's that going to work? Put them under the chuppah. The chuppah, and again, it's not magic, but what it symbolizes is that the chuppah is this encompassing light of the divine, this highest level, this house encompassing dimension of God, and within that, opposites can meld together as one. It's the higher light that brings together the opposites. It's God's making peace amongst the angels, and we ask that so too he should make peace with us. So all of this sets the stage for the chuppah. All of this sets the stage to understand what the power of a chuppah at a Jewish wedding is. It's not just a cute tradition or representative of the bride going to the home of the groom, as I mentioned before, on a very basic level. And it's not just a home that doesn't have walls, and it's love and communication and guests that are open and whatever. That's not all that it is. It's the highest divine light, which is why, by the way, you should know that a bride and a groom on the day of their wedding, so they are encouraged under the chuppah to think that whatever they think of, like the blessings that they ask for, they have a much greater power of actually being fulfilled just because of the degree of spiritual energy that exists within that space. You know what the problem is? Give me a second. The problem with all of this is that the human eye doesn't see it. If we saw the light emanating, the spiritual power emanating from the chuppah, we would be blown away. Yeah.
Now, just along these lines, it's kind of a class announcement. I saw Masha had gotten married this weekend in Jerusalem. She used to come to this class.
Yes. Yes. Masha was from Fuego Mundo. Remember Masha?
Yeah. She wasn't married. I thought she was.
She was married, and then she got
divorced. She'd been married before without this sort of God as a Rabbi. I mean, she'd been married under a Rabbi as well.
Yeah. I didn't see the on Facebook. Nice. She married an Israeli fellow.
That's
I knew she was engaged, but yeah.
Yes, yes.
Beautiful. Beautiful. She got married probably on Lag BaOmer. Probably on Thursday. That's the day of weddings. Traditional. Yeah. Very spiritual day. Day filled with light on many different levels. Yeah, so that's the core of it. So that's the Kabbalistic. What is the Kabbalah of Chuppah? Chuppah is the most transcendent divine energy that can bring together the opposites of bride and groom. And again, even their love is still distinct. It still needs a higher energy, a higher canopy, a higher chuppah to bring the two together. Good. So now, again, put yourself in the context. It's 1928. Yes? It's 1928, and you're at a wedding, and who's getting married? The Rebbe is getting married, and his father-in-law is delivering this discourse, and it's before the chuppah. So he's explaining mystically, like, what's going to happen. The wedding guests are listening to this discourse, being told, being recited. Then he explains, but before you get to the chuppah, you can't just jump into the chuppah. How do you jump into the chuppah? Such a huge experience. You can't just walk into this divine, encompassing energy, this pure, essential divine energy that's going to meld opposites together. You can't just jump in cold. You need preparation. You need to get ready for it. So what's the preparation? It's the Kabbalah's panim. It's when the groom walks to the bride and puts the veil over, gently draws the veil over her face. That is the preparation. So now we need to know, so what's that? If the chuppah is when two opposites fuse together in this much greater essential light of the divine, if that's what the chuppah is, so what's this? Ah. So I want to now give you the structure for many, many pages to follow. And here's the structure. And it's beautiful. Before you get... I want to say this in the right way. Before you get... Before you get to the main... I'm thinking like food. I don't know, main course and entree, but it's probably not a good example. But before you get... No, I think entree is the main course, right? Before you get to the entree, you need the... what's before? The appetizer, right? So before you get to the feature, to the chuppah, you need to which is the big connection, this massive melding and welding and infusion of souls together as one, right? This incredible moment, before you get that, you need a preliminary connection on a lower level. So first you have to connect on a basic level, and then you can have the larger connection. So this is going to be, thank you, yeah. This is going to be the formula that the discourse follows for the next several pages. It's going to give examples. Thank you. It's going to give examples of situations where we see that in order to get connected, you have to have a pre-connection for the real connection. You have to have a connection before the connection. Because how can you have the big connection without the little connection? So before the chuppah, which is this big connection, you have to have the Kabbalah spanim. You have to have the minor connection, which we're about to explain. Page 30. The same is true, he says, in the physical realm. Just like we spoke about God and the Jewish people, and in the end of days, in the Messianic era, God is going to put a canopy, chuppah canopy, over all of the honor, over the love of God to the Jews and the Jews to God. Still, there's something higher that brings together both, okay? Just like that's true in the spiritual realm, in the future time, the same is true in the physical realm, husband and wife, groom and bride. In the order of the wedding ceremony, first the guests come to welcome the groom. Then they walk together with the groom to welcome the bride, at which point the groom covers the bride's face with a veil. Finally, they proceed to the chuppah. Now, the truth is, we haven't explained any of the preliminaries. All we've been talking about is the chuppah. But in this one paragraph, he's revealing this point, that you can't just jump straight to the chuppah. It's like the Messianic era, doesn't just come immediately, right? It's you got to prepare for it, right? That's the end of days. But before that, you have to lay the groundwork for that great ultimate messianic time. So the same thing is true over here. It's not like you go straight to the chuppah. First you go to the groom and you welcome the groom. And then you go to the bride and you welcome the bride. And the groom puts the veil on the bride. And then after you establish all of that, then you go to the chuppah. And that's when that encompassing light is manifest, bringing together groom and bride. And here we go. Let's break it down now. The Kabbalah of... Guys, close the door, please. The Kabbalah of... Thank you. And now we have... Hey, Shia. And now we have the Kabbalah of all of these pieces. Here we go. The deeper meaning of this is, in order for there to be any union of giver and receiver, the receiver must descend so as to draw close to the giver. In other words, what he's saying is, in order for two parties to come together, and in a relationship, you're always going to have giver and receiver. And again, that can switch and flip at any point. But the point is that there's giver and receiver. But in order to have this type of union of giver and receiver, so the if we posit on a basic level that giver has, receiver doesn't have, right? So let's say teacher and student. The teacher has the information. The student does not yet have the information. So the receiver must ascend to draw close to the giver so that there can be a connection. But before this can occur, you can't just teach cold, but before this can occur, the giver must first establish an external connection with the receiver by giving something of his external faculties that will touch the external faculties of the receiver. This in turn enables the receiver to lift himself up, to rise until he becomes close to the standing of the giver so that he may then receive from the giver the deeper internal transmission. Does that make sense? It's encouched in the language of Kabbalah, but soon on the next page, we're going to get very practical examples of this. Two very, very practical examples. The point is like this. For there to be a union of two individuals, you have to first establish a premise of closeness. You can't just meld together two individuals without first establishing a common ground between them. So he's going to say that before the chuppah, there has to be this welcoming of the bride to establish this type of familiarity between the two. Although, of course, they know each other and that's why they're getting married. But there first has to be a symbolic, in a sense, connection on a basic level to then have the connection on a much deeper level. In anything in life, typically you're building up to something deeper. Right? So you have, again, in the course of a meal, so you have the appetizer and then you have the entree. In the course of teaching, which we're going to explain soon, so you also have this where you first have to establish a connection between teacher and student, and then you can teach what you're there to teach. But first you have to establish that connection. So let's read the summary, and I do want to break ground into chapter 2 because I feel like we have half the concept without the example. The example is going to make the whole thing shine. So let's read the summary. On page 30, this summary was actually written together with the discourse, so it's cool. It's like, usually I have to summarize, but here, the previous Rebbe wrote in the summary. So here we go. The discourse explains that a groom and bride correspond respectively to the supernal sefirot of Zah and Malchut. Welcoming the bride is similar to welcoming the Shabbat, which is the source of blessing for all the days of the week. Page 32, the honor of the groom refers to God's love for the Jewish people. And the honor of the bride refers to the Jewish people's love for God. The chuppah is the essential transmission. In other words, that's the essential connection. Before the chuppah, the groom covers the bride's face with a veil, which is the connection between the external faculties of the giver with the external faculties of the receiver, so that there may be a deeper, more essential transmission and reception. Again, all of that still is couched in theoretical terms. What does that mean specifically? So now we turn to chapter 2. Everyone has it, page 32? Chapter 2? Here we go. The explanation of this is, we've just stated the facts, or we've stated the concept, but we haven't yet explained it. I've done a little bit of explaining, but we haven't explained it. And again, we're explaining the structure. The structure is, before you get to the deep connection, you have to have a more superficial connection, because you can't jump right in. You have to first establish some sort of less deep connection to then get to the deep connection. So here we go. Our sages teach, our sages relate, and this is from the Talmud. And this is a quote. Before Rabbah, one of the great Talmudic sages, before Rabbah would open to begin teaching his students, he would make a humorous remark which would cause his students to laugh. Simply speaking, Rabbah would begin his lectures with a joke. I try to do that in some of my classes. It usually doesn't work. But the point is that he would... Why do rabbis and others perhaps start their sermons or their classes with a joke? It's not because, you know, we're trying to use like terrible material. No, it's because this is what the Talmud says. The Talmud says, Rabbah, one of the greatest teachers of the Talmudic era, before he would teach, he would say, Milsa dibidichusa, which is a humorous remark. His students would laugh. After that, he would sit in awe and open to begin teaching his teachings. In other words, afterwards he would get serious and then begin teaching. So it started with a joke and then he began teaching. So the question is, why? Why did he start off with a joke? If he wants to teach his students serious stuff, he's teaching Torah, why waste time? Even if it's a 30 seconds or 10 seconds, a quick one-liner, right? It's like the two ladies sitting in New York, and one says to the other, which do you think is farther, the moon or Florida? Did I say this one recently? I feel like I did. The other one says, Florida, of course. Can you see Florida from here? Right, that's a 10-second joke. I'm not saying that's what Rabbah said. I'm sure he had a high... That's terrible. I'm sure Rabbah had much, you know, loftier jokes. But the point is, why waste time? The question still stands. If you're there to teach Torah, and they're there to hear Torah, they were serious. This is Talmudic times, man. It's like, what's going on? The students were there to learn. He was there to teach. Stop wasting time. But there's a formula. You can't just go in for the kill. You can't just go in. You have to first establish. You have to get everyone open. You have to open them up to listening. You can't just start cold. You can't go from 0 to 100. You got to build this rapport. You have to build a connection. Also, by the way, when people laugh, they're open. It's not by the way. I think that's the whole point. When you bring someone to laugh, you've opened them up. They're laughing. They're showing emotion. They're open. Now you can deliver a message. It's like before that, they might be closed. Like I don't know if I like you. I don't know if I'm listening to you. I don't know who you are. But you make them laugh. They're open. Oh, you're open. Now I can teach. That's the way it is. So, and that's what he says right here. The giver, bottom of 32, the giver must quote, right? It's not literal, but must open his students. I.e. he must prepare the receiver to be fit to receive the transmission of his teachings by first exciting their senses and faculties. Then he must make another preparation to open his teachings, which entails ensuring that his teachings are measured according to the faculties of the students. So the first thing is you have to prepare your recipient. You have to get the students involved. Now, if you've ever taught kids, children, you know this is true to an even greater degree. If children are not engaged in the learning process, you're talking to the wall. That's it. I mean, no one's home. Like, it could be bright students and whatever, but they're not going to be listening if they're not interested. So you have to get them interested in the subject matter, or interested in you, open to the experience, and then you can teach. That's the way it works. So you first have to create. You see, there's always going to be an imbalance. Let's say teaching children. There's always an imbalance. There's a power imbalance. There's an age imbalance. There's an intellectual imbalance. The teacher is up here and the student is down here. We know from this already that you learn more from your students. Fine. But the way it exists on a basic plane is the teacher is older, more mature, wiser, has more authority in the classroom, and the students have younger, less mature, less wise, and don't have the power, right? That's the imbalance in the classroom. How are you relating? How are you connecting? You want to connect with the students. You want to give them your essence, the essence of your wisdom. You want to give them the essence of your wisdom. You want to transmit to the student. You want to relate to them on this level. How do you do it like this? You have to lift up the student. That's what he said on the previous page. And every giver and receiver, the giver must first lift up the recipient to be on the level of the giver and connect on a basic level and then connect on the deeper internal transmission level. So you want to give your students something deep, something profound, life-changing. It doesn't matter that they're only fifth graders. You want to give them something that they can walk home with and say, this was transformative to me, on their level, and then grow with it. How do you do that if you're up there and they're all the way down there? Watch out below, I'm dropping wisdom. Watch out, wisdom bombs. Like, it's not going to work. It doesn't go inside. It's like pouring something on top of their heads. It's like, you have to establish a camaraderie. You have to establish some sort of connection. And so the joke, the humorous remark, in a sense, I don't want to put words into the discourse's mouth, so to speak, but it, in a sense, it humanizes the teacher, right? It's like, you're also funny, or not funny, trying to be funny, I don't know, whatever it is, right? So it brings down, so to speak, the teacher a little bit, more relatable, and it lifts up the students to make them interested in this individual. Now I know I'm interested to hear what he or she has to say. You know what? That was interesting. That was fun. That was cute. I'm interested. It doesn't have to be through a joke, by the way. It could be through anything. It could be through, you know, a riddle or an opening experiment. Something that captures the attention of the students. And then once you have them, then you can give what you need to give. Then you give them then you transmit in a serious way what has to be taught. Or maybe not so serious, but in a deep way. But the model is, again, the basic form is, first the connection is formed, is fused on a basic level and then on a deeper level. So the connection between teacher and student vis-a-vis the joke, that's not why the teacher is there. That's not why the students are there. Unless it's humor 101, then that's the point. But otherwise, you're connecting on a very superficial level. Because I told the joke and you laughed at a joke, so we're connected. What kind of connection is that? Through a joke? That's not relative to the wisdom, that's very external. That's the point. You first have to connect on an external level, and then you can connect on a deeper level. If you don't connect on a superficial level, how can you try to connect on a deeper level? You're trying to jump on a roof without a ladder. It's like you're not going to get there. You're going to end up falling. You're not going to get to that deeper connection if you don't first establish what he terms here is an external connection or a superficial connection. So first you have a basic connection, superficial, and then you get to the deeper connection. That's the model. You don't have it. I have other copies, but it's just for one paragraph. Okay, so just listen. I'm going to read two lines very fast. The reason I'm doing this is because it takes us to the next little header. So, therefore, before he opened his teachings to prepare them to be ready to receive his teachings, Rabbah would make a humorous remark. That's why he told a joke. He opened with a humorous remark to open his students to be able to receive his teachings, to create that superficial connection, to then deliver the deeper connection. Okay, that's it. So that's it for today. So we learned about two things. Number one, the Kabbalah of the Chuppah. We learned some practical halachic considerations, legal considerations, and custom considerations of the chuppah, the wedding canopy. We learned the Kabbalah of chuppah, which is the divine encompassing light that can bring together opposites, including groom and bride, bride and groom under the chuppah, even though they have love, which is encompassing and love conquers all. Theoretically, it doesn't because it's still two individualized experiences, whereas the chuppah is a singular experience that it can encompass both, again, on a spiritual level because of the degree of divine light in that space. Then we describe that before you get to the chuppah, which is this deep internal connection, you first have to have a basic connection, which is when the guests go to the groom, and the groom and the guests go to the bride, and the bride puts and the groom puts the bride puts whoa, and the groom puts the veil, covers the bride's face with the veil. That is the first step that creates this basic connection in this context. That then leads to the deeper connection. And he's giving now an example of a teacher delivering humorous remarks to the students before opening the lesson of the teaching to demonstrate that sometimes, or oftentimes, or all the time, before you have the deeper connection, you have to first establish a basic, external, superficial connection. Make sense? That's it for today. So next week, we'll talk about... Actually, next week, are we meeting? We might. Next week, we have our Hebrew school graduation. So depending on how that breaks down, I'll let you know through email. Check the email. Did I get you on the email? I don't think I did. Okay, I got you. I got to get you on the email. Okay, so so check the email for next week. But whenever the next session is, either next week or the week following, we'll further develop this example of Rabbah and teaching and joking, and give another example of this, and between a parent, the other example is a parent and a child, and then we're going to bring it back to relationships and demonstrate the power of this model. All right, thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and Coffee.